Today on The Other Side, we look at Maud Barlow's new book, Too Close for Comfort.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
It's time to hear the other side of the news.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. But do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling fruit.
The other side of the news.
Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor. Till freedom is a rumor.
When I got a chance to actually sit down with Maud Barlow just before she gave a talk, the question I really wanted to ask her is the points that she was making in the book about fundamentalism, about evangelical religion, the extreme right in the legislature in the states, and how their policies are overruling doing anything about the climate change or environmental disasters. And here's what she had to say about it.
One of the great concerns that a lot of us have about this deep integration with the U.S. is that it's happening under George W. Bush. And in the book, I go in quite deeply into the so-called revolution that brought him to power, because they really do want to change things in America. They do. They want to get rid of what they call liberals, every living, breathing liberal everywhere. And a lot of the people who back him up and a lot of the people who are in power and a lot of the people who put him in power are end-time believers, and they actually believe that Armageddon is coming, and the signs of that are disasters. So hurricanes are good, environmental degradation is good, war is good, nuclear war is really good, because it speeds up the inevitable Armageddon when God will call true believers up to heaven, and then the Antichrist comes, and then it will all be fought out. So they actually don't believe in environmental regulation, because they see it's a good sign if disasters and environmental disasters take place.
You mentioned nuclear. Now, how does that tie in with the Armageddon point
of view?
Well,
if you believe in the literal interpretation of those parts of the Bible, Revelations and other few other parts of the Bible that they follow, it actually talks about horrific disasters and horrible war and devastating war, and war in which millions are killed. So they take this literally as being nuclear war, and they say that they feel that Iraq was the first good sign of a coming conflagration in the Middle East. And the Middle East is very important to them, because that's where Armageddon will take place. The Antichrist will rise, and Christ will return, and the battle for the souls of humanity will take place in Israel. And at the end of that time, every Jew in Israel is going to have to literally adopt Christ as their personal savior, or die horrible deaths and linger in horrible torture deaths for many years. It's a very violent base. These are several sects of the evangelical Christian right in the United States, and they used to kind of be not political. They were really kind of, off doing their own thing, but they have been mobilized by people like Karl Rove, who's a key Bush advisor, and who really mobilized them to become political and to vote for right-wing Republicans who would maybe not even totally agree with their view, but who are using them to get to power and are very beholden to their views.
That would explain a few things, like Pat Roberts.
Well, there are a bunch of them. There's Moral Majority, Jerry Falwell. There's a lot of them. Very much so. And when you look at their teachings, there's a lot. To me, they're anti-Christian. We're doing this interview in the Unitarian Church. I'm not at all speaking about Christianity here. I'm talking about a very popular sect of Christianity in the U.S. now moving into Canada, which is really based on intolerance and hate and a narrow worldview. And for anybody who doesn't share their worldview, they just don't mind think the thought of them, going to hell and living, having horrible deaths and living in hell forever after. This isn't bad people. This is just people who don't accept their view of religion. But they are in power. The people who are surrounding George Bush in the White House are of this ilk. Many of them, the head of the Senate, and then Tom DeLay, the House Majority Leader, and he's had to resign recently because of the scandals he's involved in. But a whole bunch of the people surrounding the president personally are right-wing evangelicals.
Are they using this as an explanation for George Bush's actions, decisions on attacking Iran and Iraq?
Well, he certainly used the argument that, God had told him to go to Iraq.
Did
and
he really?
Yes, he does. And I quoted in the book. And that, he knows that the followers from this, the far-right evangelical Christian movement, he knows that that sector is going to support war in the Middle East, because they see this as a necessary precursor to Armageddon, and they want the war in the Middle East to spread. This is for them. This is what the Bible says it will happen. So they supported the war in Iraq for all the wrong reasons. And in fact, There are millions and millions and millions of dollars that go from the right-wing Christian churches in the United States to Israel every year, not because they support Jews, but because they, you know, Israel is the site of where Armageddon will take place, and so Israel must be preserved. So it's all kind of this backwards reason for supporting a country. And, you know, and of course they don't reserve the same rights for Muslims or Arabs who won't have the choice to choose, you know, their path. I mean, they'll just, those groups will automatically be condemned to this awful death.
What kind of sort of sects of the right evangelical religion groups are these? Are they born-agains? Are they Baptists? Are they...
Come from many of those backgrounds, but this particular group's called the End Time Religion, and these are people who believe in end time. And there's a series of books called the End Time series. Tom LaHaye, this name is guy, is the author, and they've sold something like 70 million of them. And they are a whole series of books that have now been made into movies about the Armageddon and the coming of the Antichrist and the end of the earth and so on. But it's based on intolerance and lack of tolerance for diversity and other people's values and other people's religions. It's like
kind
there's only one.
Walk.
It is. It's one. There's one true religion. Cool. And they join. What I write in the book is that they have, Karl Rove and these people have harnessed this vote of these millions and millions and millions. There are about 70 million born again, or real right-wing evangelical Christian.
Do they call themselves born again?
Born again or evangelicals. They really like the term evangelical. And he's harnessed that vote, and he's put it together with the, these policy hawks who've been waiting 30 years to get the kind of government, or the George Bush type of power, and a post 9/11 scenario when Americans are ready to let them do this, to move the whole fight into, you know, the military fight internationally, to increase military spending by absolutely billions of dollars, to increase the nuclear stockpile, to be able to have what they call first strike, which is to go into and strike any country that they want, and they don't have to be threatened first. And most disturbingly, to move into the weaponization of space. And George Bush is moving war into space now. And I'm very concerned about it, because it means that we've got a whole new Cold War building up, because China and Russia are now saying, well, we can't let Bush go into space by himself. We have to be there if the Americans are going to do it. So we're really on the verge of a new space Cold War, which is, you know, going to suck up so much money and resources out of healthcare and education and the fight against poverty and the fight against,
right,
you know, the fight for clean water.
The whole environmental issue that he... So, you know, it raises one's suspicions with his behavior after 9/11, his behavior after Katrina.
Yeah, I mean, he was not remorseful at all about Katrina. He was embarrassed to be there. He didn't care about those people. I mean, I remember looking at the film clips early when Katrina hit and thinking, where are the buses? Mm. How are poor people getting out? How are little people getting out? How are old people getting out? How are the sick getting out? It was like you're on your own. If you've got somewhere to go, if you can afford a plane or you've got a car, you'll get out. And if you don't, nobody cares. And I'm telling you, nothing's changed since then. Mm. If that disaster were to happen in another part of the U.S., they would be no better prepared. They are $8 trillion U.S. dollars in debt because they have spent so much money on this war on terror and their war in Iraq and their military buildup. And it is just being sucked up out of the American people, out of infrastructure, out of healthcare, out of environmental programs. It's leaving real deep structural changes and deep, deep problems inside the U.S. itself.
How many Americans really know, do you think, that this is the agenda?
Well, it's getting more and more publicity. I noticed that this month in Vanity Fair, there's a very good article on this evangelical movement and how right-wing they are and how awful they are. So it's beginning to get out there more. I mean, when I first did research for the book, I just couldn't believe what I was finding. But since the book's come out, I've found that there is more talk. And certainly George Bush is not as popular as he was. The war in Iraq, people are turning against. They want the boys home, you know.
It takes a few people to stand up first and say it before the others start going, oh, yeah, okay, now it's my turn to say something about it.
I think so, yeah.
What do we have to watch out for in Canada then? Or who do we have to watch?
Well, what I'm trying to tell people with this book and with this tour across the country is that our government is now, based on policies that the big business community in Canada wants, is now moving to the next level of creating a kind of Fortress North America on the continent with Bush's America. Last March, they met in Waco, Texas, Bush and Martin and Vicente Fox of Mexico, and they signed something called the Security and Prosperity Partnership for North America. And it's a far-reaching agreement to harmonize immigration policy and and refugee policy and defense policy and security and regulation around food, drugs,
really?
Environment, health and safety, a whole range of areas. New resource pact for energy. Some of them are also now talking about water. And it's had no debate in this country. And that's why I'm very, very concerned about it, because there has been absolutely no debate. This blueprint for this was prepared by this Canadian Council of Chief Executives. It's the 150 biggest corporations and their lobby group, Tom DiCino. And they basically handed it to the government, and the government just kind of said yes and moved ahead with this. And nobody else's opinion matters. It's not going to Parliament. We're not getting to debate it in this election. And I look at it and I say, look, we debated the first free trade agreement, and we debated NAFTA fiercely. This arguably goes way further than either one of those. And why aren't we allowed to have a debate on it? What is this? And it, to me, it's just the big business community not wanting this to be an issue, just, you know, pushing their agenda for deregulation. Well, they want deregulation. 9/11 came in some ways as a great blessing for them, you know?
So the actual fall of the government, how much does it matter in this scenario?
Well, you know, it depends what we get at the end of this election in terms of who we... I know everybody is so cynical. I've been across the country, and I cannot tell you the cynicism that exists out there.
Really?
As one newspaper said, same candidates, same parties, same issues, so why are we having an election kind of thing? I expect we'll end up sort of where we are with this kind of minority.
Yeah.
I would like to see a stronger progressive parties, NDP and Greens and others, coming forward to force the Martin government to back off of this. I'm very worried about Stephen Harper. I think Stephen Harper would jump on this agenda way faster than Paul Martin. I think he's a pro-Bush hawk. I think that I know that he's got a lot of these same evangelical right-wingers in his party. And that's not, I'm not against anyone's private religion. It's their business. I'm talking about people who use their religion to force it, you know, their views, use politics to force their religious views
affect
on the rest of the world.
Directly,
exactly.
Yeah.
That's my concern. And it really is moving into the Conservative Party. So I'm very much hoping that we will not elect a Conservative majority or even minority.
Okay, research. What should people do for research? Where should they go?
Well, my book's a good place to start. It's full of the not only the information I'm sharing with you here, but just I break it down sector by sector on what it's going to mean for Canadian healthcare, Canadian resource policy, our civil and human rights, and so on. And I really did put, I documented where people could find the information, because I thought, you know, you can't take my word for it. Yeah, I have to be able to show what I'm talking about and where they can find this document and so on. Also, our website, Council of Canadians, canadians.org, to look for the material. We've got tons of material up there, and we keep stuff posted on our website, so up-to-date information that's happened since the book came out, for instance, would be up there. Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives is doing wonderful work as well. So there are many places for people to go to get this information. And of course, we would love people to join our group. We're nonpartisan and we're nonprofit. I'm a volunteer. I don't get paid by the council, so when I say to people, join. None of that's coming to me. It is for the organization, but the stronger we are, the more people who join us, the stronger the organization is going to be, the stronger our movement's going to be.
More information will get shared. We've been talking to Maude Barlow, author of the new book, Too Close for Comfort. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
Maude is the national chairperson of the Council of Canadians, Canada's largest public interest advocacy group. She has recently been awarded the Right Livelihood Award, which is known as the Alternative Nobel Prize.
I'm going to talk about this process called deep integration or continental integration, or some people are calling it NAFTA Plus. I call it Fortress North America. There's a variety of ways of coming at it. Basically, I'm going to start off a little bit by talking to you about what's already happened. And I'm not talking about NAFTA now, although I can talk lots about the fallout from NAFTA, but I'm talking about what's something that most people don't know, and that is that continental integration is not a threat, it's not a fear, it's not a conspiracy theory of mine. There is a very concerted plan afoot to move us into the next level of integration with the United States. For several years now, since 9/11, a plethora of task forces, working groups, coordinating committees, cross-border consultations that have been working to harmonize and operationalize the integration of many, many aspects of Canada-US life. Including creating a common market and a trade bloc comparable in many ways to the European Union. This is actually underway now, but without any of the environmental or social safeguards that were built into the European Union. Now, Fortress North America is the brainchild of the big business community, particularly the Canadian Council of Chief Executives. This is the same Tom DeCheneau that used to be the Business Council on National Issues, the 150 biggest corporations in the country, that brought us the first free trade agreement in NAFTA. And they have been pushing since NAFTA to get the next level of harmonization because they did very well, and I would argue strongly that the majority of Canadians did not do well. The top 10% people in this country hold 53% of the wealth, and that's a dramatic increase in income disparity in the last 15 years. A lot of it can be laid at the feet of free trade and deregulation and privatization and the loss of a commitment to universality. So they've been pushing this very, very hard because, of course, for the big business community, it's been the opposite. It's been wonderful. In fact, they now, collective assets of the Canadian Council of Chief Executives 15 years ago was $1 trillion. It's now $2.5 trillion. So they have done well. But they've also made us very vulnerable to the U.S. Because almost 90% of all of our exports are now U.S. bound. So then came 9/11. And the tightening of the U.S. border, and suddenly the business community said, well, we've got to keep that border open. So they're arguing now that we have to offer up all aspects of trade and border security, continental security, defense, and resources to the U.S. in order to negotiate keeping the border open. And when they're challenged about the implications of such a far-reaching kind of agreement and what this is going to do to our sovereignty, they simply argue that our economic policies and our economic reality is so deeply integrated that it doesn't matter anymore for us to have independent domestic policies. They call the difference in the regulatory regimes between our countries the tyranny of small differences. And you're going to hear that a lot. Whenever you read any of these reports, you hear this over and over again, this tyranny of small differences. Post 9/11, the first shot across the bow was from the C.D. Howe Institute, who called for what they call the big idea, and they put out a report and was followed by 13 others, and they argued that Canada should entice the U.S. government into deeper economic integration by offering full cooperation with the war on terror, more control over Canada's energy supplies, and full harmonization of regulatory regimes. Canadian Council of Chief Executives picked this up and ran with it, and they put out what they called their proposal for a North American Security and Prosperity Initiative. And it's so wide-reaching that the National Post called it a blueprint for a powerhouse North American trading bloc to take on the world, shielded by a fortress North American-style defense perimeter. And they also set up a task force with the three countries, the business communities of the three countries. The Canadian arm of it was chaired by John Manley, who's the former deputy minister under Chrétien, wants to be prime minister on the right, far right, really, of the Liberal Party, and Tom DeCheneau of the Canadian Council of Chief Executives. And they called, and this is their language, a bold vision for regional integration and a sweeping new plan for the continent. And this they called for, just to give you some of what we're talking about here, a common North American brand name, negotiating as one trade bloc the way the European Union does in the WTO, so we wouldn't be worrying about the U.S., we would be negotiating with the U.S. as one unit. One security perimeter that some people use the term ziplocking North America. One passport for the whole continent. One point of entry so that if somebody comes to visit you from another country and has no intention of going to the U.S., they would still have to convince U.S. authorities that they're allowed into the bloc. They're recommending one common immigration and refugee system, a customs union, a common currency, one inspection and testing regime so that if something has been given the okay in the U.S., like a patent or the chemical is allowed on the market, we wouldn't be allowed to have a separate regime here, and a North American resource pact, which includes energy and water. Now, this has all been put out there. I bet you haven't read about it, have you? The Toronto Star called the task force report a new vision for a fortress North America in which the continent is wrapped in a security perimeter from the Arctic to the Guatemalan border. Last March, Paul Martin and George W. Bush and Vicente Fox of Mexico met in Waco, Texas, right near Bush's ranch, and they signed something called the Security and Prosperity Partnership of North America. They took almost the exact words from the Council of Chief Executives, and they took their blueprint in whole. And they signed this thing, and then they ordered their senior bureaucrats in all three countries to come up with a plan of action. It got almost no media. It is not a treaty that has to go to the House of Commons. It is, in my opinion, a document much more far-reaching than NAFTA, and we have it's nowhere out there. I mean, I document this so that you can see where it comes from and what's in there. Paul Martin no sooner got home to Ottawa than they launched what they call the Smart Regulation Initiative. The Smart Regulation is a euphemism for deregulation. It's a WTO term that all the member countries have agreed to use, which is to harmonize regulations, but of course, usually it's downward. But in this case, we have promised to work with U.S. regulators to review, revise, and harmonize regulations in areas as diverse as food inspection, drugs, seeds, health and safety, and the environment, all in order to integrate markets across the board. And every federal department has been ordered to do this, and there are now cross-border committees working on exactly this. And in June, this past June, the report came back from the senior bureaucrats. It was called a high-level report to the leaders, and it laid out a plan to harmonize energy, nuclear security, and regulatory regimes across the continent. Now, why don't you know about this? This is the first most important question to ask. Well, there are several reasons for this. One is that the big business community doesn't want to debate on it, because if Canadians knew what was in this agreement and we had a chance to vote on it, we would overwhelmingly reject it. So it is to their advantage to make this just look like the next sort of bureaucratic level of cooperation with the U.S. and not let us debate it. As well, we do not have mainstream media anymore that is allowing these debates out. It is a very serious problem in our country. Now, I would be very worried about this in any case, but I am most particularly worried that we are going into this agreement in the regime of George W. Bush, who is arguably the most right-wing, pro-military, anti-environmental, anti-human rights president in modern American history. And what I've done is I've documented the what I call the revolution that brought this man to power, because in my opinion, Bush is just merely the most recent occupant of the seat. These folks are, you know, are very, very serious about what they call a revolution, a Republican revolution or a far-right revolution. They set out, mainly under the leadership of Karl Rove, who was a very powerful and very smart man, to remove every living, breathing, what they call liberal, from office, from every level of government, from be it school boards right up until the Supreme Court. And of course, this is going to have huge ramifications for women's rights, for minority rights, for gay and lesbian rights, and so on. And they specifically turned to a constituency that is huge in numbers, but had never been pulled in politically before, and that is the evangelical right, Christian right. And they found them. These are people generally who were not political. They didn't get involved with political parties. In fact, in many ways, they shunned politics. And Karl Rove put them on a huge mailing list and started to pull them in, and they started schools where people are taught how to become political and so on. And many, many of them, about 50 million Americans, are what they call end-time believers. And they believe that very soon, hopefully they hope it's soon, God will call up true believers into heaven and everyone else will be left behind. And they will have to negotiate who God is going to call up next and who will die a horrible death on earth. And they are waiting for Armageddon, which is going to come in Israel. And so all wars around the Middle East are good because they show that we're leading up to a war in Armageddon is coming, and it's going to happen after the Antichrist returns. And the signs of Armageddon are environmental devastation. So they literally work against the environment, against environmentalists, because they believe that environmental degradation is a sign that Armageddon is nigh. They believe that war is good, that the Iraq war was the first salvo in this war in the Middle East. They believe that nuclear war is really good, because if you look at the Book of Revelations, it talks about the kind of conflagration that happens with nuclear war. They not only voted for George Bush, but very senior people around George Bush in the White House, the Pentagon, the Senate, and the House of Representatives believe this. Just give you one example is James Inhofe, who's a senator from Oklahoma. And James Inhofe is a very strict hawk, a foreign policy hawk, very, very aggressive about the Middle East. He says there's nothing that he is asked to decide on that he can't find a literal command in the Bible to do. And he is hates environmentalists, hates the Environmental Protection Agency, is set out to shut it down. is supported by the big oil industry, and George Bush put him in charge of the Senate Environment Committee. Just to give you an example of what I'm talking about, clearly I could not make this up. Now, they joined forces with the foreign policy hawks, who are a lot more sophisticated, these folks, but they've made common cause. And these are the people like Wolfowitz and Cheney and Rumsfeld, who've been waiting 30 years for the opportunity to move their agenda forward. They believe that the U.S. is destined to be the world's sole superpower and should not be ashamed to use its might to promote its values around the world. And, of course, it's under these people that America has adopted the so-called first strike policy, where they are allowed to go into countries without having been provoked first. All of this is backed up by and paid for by huge business interests that are raking in billions of dollars under George Bush. He's now running an $8 trillion US debt now because of the spending on their war on terror, which has now got this whole new thing called data mining, where they gather as much information about people as they can, Americans, the people around the world, and then they have these computer programs where they try to decide project who might be a terrorist or who might have tendencies to be a troublemaker. And that's a huge business. The energy industry, of course, because of the wars and so on, and then defense. And they are literally spending billions and billions more on defense. And I document in the book how the senior defense people are also making policy in the Pentagon and the White House. And it's just kind of like a revolving door going back and forth. This year, I added it all up, 2005-2006, they will spend $1 trillion between their military and their so-called war on terror. And of course, you know what that's doing to their people. They are building up the nuclear stockpile. George Bush refuses to participate in the non-proliferation of weapons. And in fact, they are now taking the arms race into space. Donald Rumsfeld says that the United States is going to face a space Pearl Harbor and must take and keep command in space. And I've got lots of quotes I can give you, so you don't have to take my word for it, but I'll just give you one from the chief of the Air Force Space Command, whose name is, if you can believe it, General Lance Lord. And General Lance Lord says, "Space superiority is essential to our vision of controlling and fully exploiting space to provide our military with an asymmetric advantage over our adversaries. Space superiority may not be our birthright, but it is our destiny. It is the American way of fighting." Though we are talking about a new Cold War in space that is going on now. Now, to pay for this, Bush has made war on the American people and sucked the lifeblood out of infrastructure and environment and healthcare and so on, which, of course, we all saw with the New Orleans disaster. On the area of the homeland security, he has undermined human rights and civil liberties of Americans and people around the world. Between their Homeland Security Act and the Patriot Act and dozens of other acts, they have created what some are calling an American gulag. These are these prisons, both within the U.S. territory and around the world, where prisoners are held and treated in horrible ways. And many, many of them are sent to places like Syria and Egypt, where they are tortured or disappeared. And I quote a CIA agent in there who says, "This is the way it works. If we don't have enough information or proof to charge someone, we put them on this plane." They call it the torture plane, and they send them off to one of these countries. And they tell the interrogator in the morning what it is they want to know, and by the evening, the interrogator gives them the information, and their hands are clean. There are now 5 million people on the U.S. Master Terror Watch list. Can't all be terrorists, right? Of course, they include environmentalists, human rights activists, and civil libertarians. William Schultz, the head of Amnesty International, says that George Bush has taken the U.S. back to a time before human rights were a part of the political vocabulary. Same thing on the environment. I document just massive deregulation of the environment, which started in Texas when George Bush was the governor there. And he set up a voluntary code with the energy and the car sectors and others saying, you know, you no longer have to abide by the law. That's for little people. You negotiate, you make an agreement with my government and keep it or not, fine yourselves, pay it or not, I don't care, hands off. And he took those people, particularly the big people in energy, and he brought them to the White House with him, where they've gone through this massive deregulation across the board. Robert Kennedy Jr. says that Bush and company have launched over 400 major rollbacks of U.S. environmental law, including the Clean Air and Clean Water Acts, and taken the country back to a time before ecological consciousness. It's exactly what Amnesty says about human rights. They say that Bush has taken the country back to a time before human rights were a part of the vocabulary in the U.S. And then there's been the assault on working families and the poor. The differences between the social classes in the U.S. is absolutely breathtaking. The top 10% now own two-thirds of the wealth. That is the great, the U.S. is now the country with the greatest income inequality in the world. Under George Bush, the United States, among developed countries, ranks dead last in fighting poverty, is at the bottom in terms of functional literacy, has one of the lowest levels of life expectancy, the greatest and most permanent income inequality, and the highest number of citizens living without health insurance. With 22% of its children living in poverty, it is only marginally better than Mexico in this category. The minimum wage, the federal minimum wage at $5.15 an hour, has not been raised in almost a decade, and there are now what 90 million what they call double poor in the U.S. That means these are people who are so poor that if you doubled their income, they would still be living below the poverty line. And this statistic stunned me. I had to keep going back to be sure I got it right. The Bush administration has cut welfare payments by 13% per year since they took power in the year 2000. Can you imagine what it's like trying to exist if you're on minimum wage, or you've lost your job, or you got sick and you couldn't, and you lost your job because you got sick, and then you lost your health insurance because your health insurance is connected to your job, and so on down the line. Or as one woman said to me, well, he has created lots of jobs. I myself have three of them. Find our humor where we can, right? So while the profits from the corporations are soaring and CEOs are taking home unprecedented salaries, the cost of living has grown faster than the rise in income for most working families who are now living with historic levels of debt. And to stay competitive with the global economy, so beloved of the Bush administration, corporations are now telling their workers they have to take huge pay cuts, wage cuts, or lose their jobs. Now, what is the impact on Canada on signing the Security and Prosperity Partnership of North America? What is the impact on us that we have signed this agreement? Well, I have to tell you, some of the impact has already started. Post 9/11, we've already brought in quite draconian legislation on so-called security, homeland security, that really mirrors what happened in the U.S. In particular, I would point to two things. One is the Safe Third Country legislation, which says that anyone seeking refugee status in Canada now that had to come across the U.S., i.e. anyone from Latin America, must be turned back at the border to the U.S. where they have to seek asylum there. Well, we have traditionally taken way more people from Latin America than the U.S. So what's happening is those folks now are having to turn back to the U.S. where they seek asylum, and they're put in holding tanks, basically, and sent back to their country of origin. I'm also very concerned about the USA Patriot Act, because it says that every American company, whether it's operating on American soil or internationally, must share with Homeland Security any information that it has from its work with Homeland Security, no questions asked. So, for instance, the census, American Census post 9/11, was required to pull out all of the files on all Americans of Arab and Muslim descent, and that had to be shared with Homeland Security. Did you know that Lockheed Martin, the world's biggest weapons manufacturer, U.S. company, got the contract for the Canadian Census? Because under NAFTA, you can't say it has to be a Canadian company. So now this company is going to have access to every single bit of information about every one of us. These are the folks that designed the guidance system for the ABM missile. I don't like the fact that they have my postal code. And I don't think you should be happy with it either. Stats Canada says, don't worry, we'll put up a firewall. No, excuse me. They're going to have this information. They get billions of dollars from the Pentagon every year. If Homeland Security says to them, we want you to pull out, you know, information on Canadians of Arab and Muslim, you know, background, or people who've been involved in dissent or whatever, they're going to do it. They have to do it. Equally, I'm very concerned about defense. Yes, we said no to the war in Iraq, which was good, and yes, we said no to the ballistic missile defense project of George Bush, which was good, but Paul Martin was in a minority situation, and he can read the polls, and he knew that Canadians didn't want this. But what you may not know is that, to say we're sorry for that, Canada has brought out a long-awaited foreign policy review. Again, it got no media last April. And basically, its recommendations mirror the foreign policy position of the Canadian Council of Chief Executives and recommends a North American security and defense partnership. And we have already signed what they call interoperability agreements on strategy and technology, which is why the increase in funding to the armed services is not going to the men and women of the armed services, as some of us would have hoped, but rather to this interoperability and onto big weapons and big ships and big planes and so on. And you should know that it means that we're moving away from peacekeeping. 12 years ago, for every $10 we spent on the military, $9 and some was under the auspices of the UN peacekeeping missions. Today, for every $10 we spend, only 31 cents is to do with peacekeeping. And so when did we get to vote on that? Do you remember voting on that? Gee, I don't. On energy, they keep talking about this energy pact, a new energy pact, and I think, well, what more can they give us? Can we give than we gave in NAFTA, which was basically proportional sharing? We agreed to give away as much energy as the Americans would buy, right? And so we are now sending south 70% of all our oil production. We're having to import almost 50% of our oil needs because we have made this agreement. And we can't cut back because that's the way it is. That's the agreement we signed. It doesn't belong to us anymore. Those resources are North American and they are totally and completely corporate owned. So I asked myself, well, what more do they want? What could you want after that? But the more I read and the more I researched, the more I realized they want two things. The Canadian Council of Chief Executives wants to guarantee U.S. corporations control over the Athabasca tar sands. They don't want China in there. They want, this is the quid pro quo, keep that border open and we will give you the tar sands and we'll give you all of the gas from the Mackenzie Valley pipeline. That's the real agenda here. And the other agenda is, and we will deregulate the environmental assessment process that goes with it now, because there are 14 environmental jurisdictions involved in the Mackenzie Valley pipeline. And you mark my words, they're going to speed that thing through and bypass the environmental process. And the Athabasca tar sands are on their way to being totally controlled by U.S. corporations. On water, I am deeply, deeply concerned. I did a lot of research on this. There is no Canadian water policy. We have no protection for our water from export, from privatization, from being controlled by corporations. And it was very interesting. We got a hold of a leaked copy of the minutes of one of the meetings of this task force with Dequino and Manley. And it says right in there, we all agree that water will be part of this new block, trade in water, corporate trade in water, but it's very politically sensitive in Canada right now, so we won't have it in our final report. But there it is, and I document it in the book. And I can smell. It's a terrible gift I have. I feel like, what's the program with the woman who can, who's, thank you. What's it called? The medium. I feel like a medium. I feel like I can tell what issues are coming up before they happen. This water issue is heating up. I debated Paul Cellucci, the former UN ambassador to, or U.S. ambassador to Canada, a few weeks ago on CBC, and the first thing he said to me was, so why don't you want to sell us our water? You know, you sell us our energy. What's wrong with it? And I thought, you wouldn't be doing this just innocently. You are raising this because this is being raised in Washington, and this is, you know, this is a shot across the bow. And then I don't know if you guys saw last week's McLean's front page story has a picture of George Bush holding a glass of water. It says, America's getting thirsty. Let's sell them our water before they come and take it. This is McLean's, you know. Well, why don't you just go down and become an American arm of the American government right now? I guess you can do that by just staying here. So I am very, very worried. And if you look on Environment Canada, you punch in Environment Canada and then punch in National Water Policy, you will see that the last thing that was ever put up there was in 1987. It's even got a picture of the environment minister from then. His name was Tom McMillan. He was Mulroney's environment minister in 87 until he got defeated in 88. That's the last thing up there. That's how much we care about our water. Why wouldn't the Americans think they can come in and take it? Healthcare, it's going to be a huge fight, and it will, I think, be one of the issues in the election, hopefully, but I would, of course, like to see this as part of a larger discussion. We have the Supreme Court case. We have Quebec moving to bring in legislation to allow for-profit services. We have Alberta moving ahead. We have BC moving ahead. We have the for-profit cancer clinic from the US coming into Toronto. It's happening fast. And I want to remind you that under NAFTA, there is an exemption for healthcare, but it's only applicable as long as we're delivering healthcare on a non-commercial basis. The more we privatize, the more rights American for-profit corporations have to come in and say, not only can we set up shop here, but we can demand equal government funding to the not-for-profit Canadian health institutions. And finally, these are all my worries. You're getting them all at once, and I'll get to the good stuff, what we can do. But finally, I am really worried about this smart regulation, which is really deregulation commitment that we've made, and the effect that it's going to have on environment, health, and safety rules, because in essence, this is the last frontier of sovereignty. If you hand over your rights as a sovereign people to set your own standards on what your food system is going to be like, and what chemicals and what drugs and so on you're going to allow, you hand away the last vestiges of sovereignty, and so much of it is gone. I came upon almost by accident the fact that for its compliance to this initiative, Environment Canada has set up what they call sectoral negotiating tables with five sectors, energy, chemicals, mining, automobiles, and forest, to set up a voluntary code for each of these sectors. So that just like George Bush's Texas, they can opt out of the laws of the land and set up a voluntary code. And that's because Environment Canada's new mandate is a dual mandate. One mandate is to protect the environment of Canadians, and the other is to promote the competitiveness of Canadian companies around the world. Now, if you don't think that's a conflict, I don't know. I worry about you. And we are very worried about food. Before the House of Commons, hopefully it died, but it'll be resuscitated, is C-27, which would allow the Canadian Food Inspection Agency to privatize food inspection services, which is what they've done in the U.S. I mean, do we need this with mad cow and bird flu? And except I think bird flu is actually a way to totally corporatize the... Anyway, I guess give my worries about bird flu. I don't think it's coming. I think it's a way to get us to never have a human touch a chicken again, and it's a way to totally turn that whole sector over to a corporate entity. And next thing you'll know, only genetically engineered birds are safe, and I can just taste where this one's going. You see, I should have my own program on television. And similarly, they are moving now to replace the Canada Food and Drugs Act so that they replace the precautionary principle, which is where you have to, in theory, prove that something is safe before it's put on the market, with something called a risk assessment, which is where you can say, well, now how many people could be allowed to get sick or even die before we have to worry about the ramifications? It's a science. It was designed by a particular guy, John Graham, and he is now, he set up this department at Harvard that was funded by the big business community. He's now George Bush's personal head of the Bureau of Management at the White House, and he oversees all the deregulation across the board. So we are harmonizing there as well. Okay, you can tell I think we have a problem. Deep integration of our continent is happening steadily, it's happening comprehensively, and it's happening below the radar screen of Canadians. And it is also being driven almost exclusively by the needs and interests of the big business community. And the voices of those concerned with healthcare, education, human rights, social justice, the environment, women's rights, international development, cultural diversity, and workers' rights have been sidelined. Absolutely sidelined. We haven't even been asked for our opinion. So we at the Council have launched a campaign working in concert with many other groups, environmental groups, labor groups. We're working with QP, the Canadian Union of Public Employees, faith-based groups, human rights groups, and so on, because we feel to stop and reverse this process, because we believe that joining the Bush Revolution would be the worst possible thing for Canada. And in fact, that by signing this Waco Pact, we've already become a kind of enabler, allowing the Bush team to stay its destructive global course. A better course would be seeking out and working with the many millions of Americans who are equally appalled at their government and the triumvirate who brought them to power. So we're calling for a full moratorium on this and a full public debate. We were when we thought the election was going to be in the spring, we were hoping that we would be able to get this issue out there for then. It may or may not be in time for this election, although I am hoping that we will raise it at all candidates' meetings, and that and where the Council of Canadians is putting a voter's guide together based on the questions here, so you'll know where the parties stand on each of these issues. We very strongly believe we need a Canadian energy strategy, a national water policy, to stop the privatization of healthcare, to reverse this so-called smart regulation, deregulation process. And we believe that we need to recognize that by refusing to abide by the softwood lumber ruling, the U.S. itself has abrogated NAFTA, and Canada is no longer obliged to abide by its onerous conditions. Now, I'm just going to end my formal remarks tonight so we can chat with each other instead of me talking at you with what I call the four great questions of our time, because I think one can look at these issues in just a Canadian perspective, or one can put these as part of a larger international perspective, and I would prefer the latter if we can. For me, the four great questions of our time are the following. The first is how to deal with the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, particularly the move to weaponized space. And I spoke to a group of high school students last week in Calgary, and I saw their faces fall when I talked to them about the fact that, you know, that there was this new level of the Cold War that was moving up into, and their generation would be having to deal with this. I felt I shouldn't have told them or something, you know, because it isn't fair to dump that on this eager group of young people. And this was a very sophisticated group. They had wonderful teachers, and they'd really learned about a lot of these issues, and they deeply cared about the environment and so on. But I think we need to recognize that China and Russia have said if the U.S. goes into space, there go we too. We cannot allow the U.S. to go there alone. And so we need to ask ourselves, we know where the U.S. is. They have space superiority. They're going to keep it. They're just very clear, at least under this administration. Where will Canada be? I mean, I dream that our government would hold a summit with like-minded countries around the world and call, you know, for the end of the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, particularly into space. Right now, that doesn't seem likely, but we can dream, and we can have this can be one of the goals that we work towards. The second great question for me is how to deal with deepening poverty and injustice within countries and between the global north and the global south. We know that there is a growing equality gap within all countries. The statistics on China are stunning, by the way. When you read about how wonderfully China's doing, just remember, it's only for a certain small class. It's really not for everybody at all. Same with India. You are seeing this division of classes within every country and, of course, between the global north and the global south. We know what the U.S. position is, more privatization. They forced privatization of healthcare and education on the third world. The latest is water, although this is Europe more than the U.S. And now, you know, if the World Bank says if you want any kind of relief or you want any kind of debt relief, or you want any kind of water aid, you have to bring in these corporations to deliver your water on a for-profit basis. Canada's been in there like a dirty shirt on this. We are just as bad, we're just not as big. And we have got to hold our government accountable for this. The third, to my mind, the third great question of our time is how to end fundamentalism, extremism, violence, and terrorism. And it's very clear what the Bush administration's answer is to this great question, and that's more bombs, borders, and Bibles. And I guess the question for us in Canada is, can we define security in a different way? Can we really look at the issue of security in a more total way as human security, the right to live with dignity, with clean water and food and shelter and, you know, the basics of life that we have come to take for granted in our country? Can we enlarge the definition of security beyond this notion that we all have to be watching the skies or the trains for terrorists? And the last question is how to acknowledge and deal with the ecological limits of the Earth, particularly climate change and the growing crisis of the shortages of energy and fresh water. I go again to China, where just this story of this economic miracle, so that all your running shoes and shower curtain liners and everything else come from China. They're destroying their environment. They're destroying their water table. 400 of the 600 cities in northern China are in absolute water drought now. I mean, it's not just cyclical drought. They have literally taken the water. Beijing makes this decision on its own, doesn't ask anybody, and reroutes that water from people's farms and people's valleys and people's communities and just sends that water to its corporations so that it drives this economic engine. They are building dozens of cities in the interior of China the size of New York. We have no idea what's happening in that part of the world. It's not sustainable. And the question again, where will Canada be? Will we be part of a sustainable alternative? Will we adopt the notion of subsidiarity, where if something can be grown or made closer to home, that we're going to create that kind of support in our economic and political systems? Where will Canada stand on these great questions of our time? I fear that while Paul Martin stands up and sounds like he's standing up to the US, in fact, he is adopting the worst possible position on these four great questions of our time by having signed the agreement that he did, and by many other actions that our governments have taken over the last 20 years. For me, there's no more important set of questions on the eve of an election. The world needs a counterweight to the Bush revolution. And I would offer as the counterweight the founding narrative of our country. We had ancestors, so few of them, living mostly strung out along the Canada-US border in this great, big, vast, harsh country. And they learned one lesson. And that lesson was, if they didn't share, they wouldn't survive. And so they built what I call ribbons of interdependence. Those are our social programs and the CBC and our East-West energy links and the railway and all of that. Those were the ribbons of interdependence that built a country. That's a very different narrative than survival of the fittest, which is more of the American narrative, although there are millions of Americans who would dearly love to swap ours for theirs or theirs for ours and would share a very different set of values for North America. But I would say to you this evening that there's never been a time that where the notion of sharing for survival, where our narrative for sharing for survival is not the most important thing Canada could offer the world. And the great question for us, and this should be the great question of this election, is, are we ready for this? Thank you very much.
I just wanted to cap off this show by pointing out a few things. There is a federal election. We do need to get involved. By saying it's hopeless to vote and you don't want to vote, then you're handing over your future, your children's future, and your grandchildren's future if there's a chance that there's still air to breathe and water to drink for your great-grandchildren. You're handing their futures over to big business, rich bureaucratic powers that finance the government who don't believe in sharing resources with everybody. Greenhouse gas emissions are going to reach double pre-industrial levels by 2080. That's enough to increase in warming similar to the end of the Ice Age. And with higher temperatures, there is more energy driving the Earth's climatic systems, which in turn cause more violent weather events, severe storms, floods, droughts, dust storms, crumbling coastlines, saltwater intrusion of groundwater, failing crops, dying forests, and inundation of low-lying inlands, the spread of endemic disease and malaria, and it continues on and on. Similarly, the world is running out of fresh water, and as economic globalization, industrialization, and urbanization draws down the existing stock. Now, we can see this if we look at places like India. The legacy of factory farming, flooding integration, the construction of massive dams, there's toxic dumping, wetlands and forest destruction, urban and industrial pollution has damaged the Earth's surface water so badly that we are now mining underground water reserves far faster than nature can replace them. Ancient aquifers are either being drained or destroyed by pollution. The result of all this, Maud says, the Earth is beginning to resemble an apple that is drying up in the inside with brown spots on the otherwise healthy-looking skin. And that reminds me of another very knowledgeable urbanist, Jane Jacobs, when she said, "Death rot from within." That's what she's talking about. Deep integration is what Jane Jacobs has been warning us about. You have to vote. The only way to stop this is to be aware. First, make yourself aware. Keep in mind that the mainstream media and the mainstream press is largely owned by big business. They aren't allowed to say a lot of things that we should be hearing. it would be a conflict of their interests. So if you want your news, you have to go to places like Council of Canadians and Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives. There are an awful lot of independent and underground, as I call them, news sources. The web is literally full of them. And they are all done by volunteers, well-seasoned, trained journalists and reporters, getting the truth right off the streets. Hamilton Indie Media happens to be just one of them, but there are several of them. We have Mayday Magazine right here in Hamilton that is speaking out exactly what's happening. We are now the majority. The middle class and the poor are the majority. 10 to 20% of the people in North America hold 90% of the wealth. It's got to stop. When these candidates come to your area, ask them about this deep integration. Ask them about end time believers. Are they an end time believer? That'll give you a lot of clues about where their politics lay and if they're interested in the environment. And ask them why, flat out. Why do you not think that working on climate control changes is a thing that we should be doing? We're killing our planet. We have just witnessed one of the worst years for storms all across the world. This is not Armageddon that's coming. This is man's creation. Man has changed his environment with all the pollution in the air. He's increased the temperature of the Earth's surface. That's fairly common and accepted news now. Most people will have to agree after the last year of the severe storms and hurricanes, tornadoes, we must say it's true. Man has changed his environment, and it's up to man to fix what he's damaged. Let's not sit by and watch Earth become destroyed from stupidity and ignorance.